Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. Jamaica is an island nation of two personas. One, the fantasy of glorious beaches and sun known to outsiders, tourists. The other, the reality of grinding poverty familiar to many of the poor in Jamaica. The other, Jamaica, is a country whose citizens have also grappled with classism, homophobia, and colorism. The lighter the skin, the more worthy some consider you to be. And this hour's guest, Nicole Dennis Benn, has nimbly captured all of this in her acclaimed first novel, Here Comes the Sun. And Nicole Dennis Benn is with us in studio this hour of Radio Time. So nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Nicole, before we dive into the novel and its four primary characters, let's get a sense of your story. You grew up in Kingston, Jamaica?
Yes, I did. So I was born and raised in Kingston, Jamaica, in a small town, vineyard town, Kingston 3. See, I'm actually speaking Jamaican here. Kingston 3. And it was a very great upbringing. You know, we had a lot, you know, our parents made sure to provide for us so that we weren't aware of the class differences until later on, which I know we'll discuss. But growing up, I had a great childhood. You know, it was all, you know, the huge garden, huge front yard, trees that we could climb, pick fruits, you know, and that was my most fond memories growing up in Kingston, Jamaica, in Vineyard Town.
Yeah, so it was beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. And you were slipping into what's called the patois?
Yes.
So now what is that to the culture of Jamaica, patois?
Very important. You know, it's so sad in that we are encouraged not to speak it in public. And
By whom?
By our teachers, for sure. Of course, now there's a huge debate with the government, with the Ministry of Education, as to whether we should have patois being our second language or first language, because it really is our first language, but because of we were colonized by the British, so we were, you know, forced to speak English language. And one thing is that when you speak to most Jamaicans, casually, it would be patois. We're speaking to each other. But in a professional setting, it would definitely be standard English. And standard mm-hmm. English is looked at, is also class-wise too, where you're more educated when you speak that language. Mm-hmm. And to me, though, a lot of children are in school who are in households who only speak patois in those households and come to school and expect to comprehend the standard English of the teacher. And so sometimes there's miscommunication there. You know, so a lot of our children, you know, end up not comprehending in that full sense, and they get criticized for being backwards for speaking it, right? So in Here Comes the Sun, for example, you see Tandy going through that, in that, you know, she was forced, or, you know, she forces herself to only present herself that way.
Yeah.
And I went through that too. You know, I went to a very elite high school in Kingston as well, St. Andrew High School for girls. And, you know, we were told not to speak this language. So it's just interesting how now I'm writing the dialogue that way.
Yes.
Even my own mother exclaimed to me, and my siblings, like, oh my gosh, Nikki, you're speaking patois in your book. And I'm like, yes, I still think in patois. You know, everything, my thought process is in patois. But when I speak, you know, I make a mental note to it, to present it in standard English.
Yeah.
So that's why that slip just happened now, where the H was swallowed in three.
We don't mind.
Okay, awesome. Good.
And I was going to mention, much of the dialogue in the book is in patois.
Yes.
So, which definitely, I feel, really gives you a sense of the culture.
Exactly.
People in Jamaica. So let's get into the book. The novel is set in when? 1994?
1994, yes.
Okay. And one of the narratives is that of a love story between two women, Margot and Verdine. And tell us a bit about their story.
Yeah, so Margot and Verdine's story, very beautiful love story. You know, I wrote that because I really feel that Margot herself, yes, you know her character in grappling with her own identity and also upward mobility, her drive to, you know, aspire to get more from her own country. But Verdine came along, you know, Margot has always been in love with Verdine ever since, you know, she was a little girl. And so here are two women who literally grew up together and, you know, fell in love. And so because of the cultural norms, though, Margot struggles internally with embracing Verdine fully as her partner. And that's something, you know, realistically, you know, we're talking about 1994 here. We're talking about a working class woman who's Margot, who doesn't really see herself falling for this woman and, you know, even risking it being found out. And so that's something that I had to really write well between those two women.
Well, at least at the time, a couple of decades ago, homosexuality in Jamaica was not accepted.
Right. It's not. Still not accepted.
Still not.
Yeah. It's.
I'd read that there were starting to be changes, but no.
No, not really. So I definitely always emphasize for individuals that it's a class dynamic. Is there something about you having access and money that prevents you from being subjected to anything negative that comes with being gay or lesbian in the country? Right. So, you know, back in 1994, yes, you probably might hear the stories or the disappearance of men who were found out to be gay, for example. No, I mean, you hear those stories, but it's not as much in that sense of like violence. But what's happening now in the country itself, because the gaze of America and Europe looking to Jamaica as, oh my gosh, like it used to be, it is our paradise in the sense of tourism. Mm. And so a lot of individuals try hard to cover that up, you know, so, oh my gosh, like they don't want other individuals saying we're homophobic, so they won't come to the island. So no, there's a movement to make it look like a flower bed for individuals, but it's not, you know. If you're a working class and you're impoverished and you're a gay or a lesbian, you're not going to survive if you're found out to be an openly gay.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous, yes.
Okay.
Yes, unless if you're, I know there are lesbians and gays in like design and art. I mean, of course, in academia for sure. And those individuals can actually exist, but they're existing in a gated community, a very protected or insulated realm.
And you get into classism in depth in your book and in your characters. So we talked a little bit about Margot and Verdine, and we'll talk some more about them. But Margot's mother is,
yes,
Dolores.
Yes.
And she has a sister, Tandy. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yes. So Margot is very close with Tandy. You know, they're 15 years apart. Margot is 30 years old. Tandy's 15. And Margot really takes Tandy under her wings. You know, they're so, she doesn't want Tandy to end up where she has ended up. You know, she prostitutes herself in the hotels, and she does this so that Tandy can go to school and become better. She wants Tandy to be a doctor. But Tandy, that's not what's on Tandy's mind. Tandy wants to be an artist. Tandy sees her upward mobility being lighter skin. So Tandy's more preoccupied with that. Right. Meanwhile, Margot herself is really busy hoping that Tandy does not fall into Dolores's lens in terms of selling her the way how she sold Margot.
So Dolores, and we have to mention these characters again, they live in poverty.
Yes.
And Dolores had Margot when she was very young.
Yes, when she was 16.
And I'd like you to read a passage for the book. We have time before the break here. This is it starts on page 201. And Dolores has a stall at the local market, and she makes a snap decision to prostitute Margot when Margot is not quite 14.
One day, a tall, dark-haired man walked into Dolores' stall. He was wearing sunglasses, like most tourists. He had a presence about him, an air Dolores associated with important people, white people, like the ones who just bought out her stall. Except the man wasn't white. A mixture, maybe, a mulatto kind. He wore a button-down shirt that revealed the dark hairs on his chest. When Dolores peered up at him, she saw he was peering down at Margot. He turned to Dolores, his eyes hidden behind the shades. "How much?" he asked in a voice that sounded to Dolores like thunder. "The dolls are 20, sir." "Oh, and the figurines go for 15. U.S. But I can give you for 10. And the T-shirts, they're unique, sir. Only one of a kind. Only $15. "No," the man said, returning his focus to Margot. "I'm talking about her." He used his pointed chin to gesture to a skinny Margot, who at the time had barely started menstruating or growing breasts. Dolores looked from her daughter to the tall stranger wearing the sunglasses. "She's not on sale, sir." The man pulled out a wad of cash and began to count it in front of Dolores. Dolores watched him count 600 bills. She had never seen so much money in her life. The crispness of the bills and the scent of newness, which Dolores thought was what wealth must smell like. The possibility of moving her family out of Riverbank, affording her daughter's school fee, books, and uniforms, buying a telephone and a landline for her to call people whenever she liked instead of waiting to use the neighbor's phone. All these possibilities were too much to swallow all at once. But she's only 14. I'm staying right down there. He gestured to the large cruise ship, which was in plain sight. I'll have her back before dinner. The man placed the bills in front of Dolores. She tore her eyes away from the stack to look into the terrified eyes of her daughter. Marga was shaking her head slowly, mouthing no. But Dolores had made up her mind the minute the scent of the bills hit her. Her eyes pleaded with her daughter's and also held in them an apology. Please understand. Do it now and you'll thank me later. Dolores hoped her eyes communicated. She nodded to the man when Margo looked away defeated. The man took Margo somewhere. Dolores didn't ask where. It was in the direction of the ship that had docked for the day. The girl followed behind him, her steps uncertain. She never looked back to see the tears in Dolores' eyes.
So throughout the book, Dolores is a terribly unsympathetic character. She's cold. She's calculating. Although you sense in that passage that, you know, she cared about her child. But is this something that happens with some frequency among the very poor?
That's the thing. So first of all, let me so Dolores' character, Dolores really loves her daughters. That's the thing, you know, and over again in the book, or she stated once in the book, she's a good mother. In her eyes, she's a good mother by doing whatever it takes to provide for her children, even if it's selling Margot at that time. And, you know, Dolores also loves her daughter so much that she would be the first one to tell them, listen, you know, the world is not going to love you, you know, as black girls or as girls who are of our class. So, you know, either you know it now or you move into the world and find out from someone else or other people. And so, you know, that's the kind of love Dolores has. And in terms of poverty and what mothers will go through, yes, there are definitely women on the North Coast, for example, who this is actually, and not even only on the North Coast, even in Kingston, who will sell their bodies, you know, for money.
Sure.
And I mean, it happens all over the world too, but I was really mostly aware of it returning back to the island and seeing for myself, you know, the level of like where these women would actually go to make money or make ends meet.
It's very hard to feel any sympathy for Dolores in the book, even though there are glimpses of this love for her children. But you don't seem to judge, and we're up against a break. But quickly, why is that? Why do you not seem to judge this character?
Yeah, I love all my characters. That's the thing. I really love Dolores. I really love Margot, Tandy, and Verdine. Dolores, really, the reason why I love Dolores so much, she's actually the voice that I was hoping that would carry through to show our post-colonial scars.
Okay, more on that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Nicole Dennis-Benn is here with us with her first novel, Here Comes the Sun. We're talking about it this hour of Radio Times. As always, we invite you to join the conversation at 888-477-9499 or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. Nicole Dennis-Benn is in studio with us. We're talking about her new novel, Here Comes the Sun. And if you have questions or observations you'd like to share, the number is 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Nicole, Jamaica is a country in which a person's class is felt keenly, at least at the time this novel was set, again,
right,
about 20 years ago. The character Tandy is in love with a street boy. Who seems to have all the qualities any mother might want for her child. You know, he's kind, he's patient, he works hard. And yet this relationship would not work in the eyes of Dolores.
Right. Exactly. Yes, classism is it's definitely something on the island, not only in the 90s, but now still, right? There's a division there. And that's something else that, you know, is not talked about. It's also very hidden. You know, we have this motto, out of many one people, but it's not. You know, we don't talk about, you know, there's no clear dialogue about anything about the disenfranchised people of African descent there, you know. So growing up, I was always aware of that. And somehow it came out in this novel as well, where there is this strong there's a strong display of I wouldn't say how would I put it? Dolores herself is like a Charles in the setting, though. She's also poor. She's also not from a well-to-do family. But in order for her to, she wants to see her daughter rise above that. So yes, Charles has great qualities, but she would never want her daughter to end up where she is. And so falling in love with a boy like Charles definitely does not prove promising. For Dolores or for Tandy. Mm. And even Margot says the same thing as well. You know, Margot herself would say, well, yes, you know, you need to aspire to like those other boys, you know, those boys who are wealthier. But in order to do that, you have to, you know, do that social climbing. And for Tandy, through her education that they see that would happen.
And Tandy thinks she also has to lighten her skin.
Yes.
In order to achieve that. You tackle colorism, the prejudice against skin shade, among, at least in the culture in Jamaica. Dolores telling Tandy at one point, remember this, nobody loves a black girl, although that's said in patois, which I'm not going to attempt. So so Tandy decides to get her skin lightened, which Charles, first of all, disapproves of, but it also is such a dangerous practice, seemingly. And if you would read another passage from your book, this is when a neighbor, Miss Ruby, who does this lightening, it's on page 24, applies a chemical concoction to lighten Tandy's skin.
Yes. I used to be black like you, but look at me. Miss Ruby turns her head from side to side. For Tandy to see her salmon-colored skin, delicate with a texture of scalded milk. See how bright my skin come? If you follow instructions, yours will get this way quicker. Now that you have the Queen of Pearl, you might be lucky. If you want faster results, use it twice a day. She rubs the concoction up and down Tandy's neck, back, arms, and shoulders. She rubs everywhere but her butt. Miss Ruby's hardly tender. Tandy wonders if Miss Ruby's roughness is punishment for not having followed her early instructions. She imagines her blackness peeling off, the hydrogen peroxide Miss Ruby pours into the mixture acting like an abrasive, a medicine for her melancholy. She closes her eyes as the warm formula touches her skin. Miss Ruby works her way to Tandy's chest. The circular motion of a stranger's hands on her breast makes Tandy blush. She has never been touched this way. She opens her eyes and searches for something, anything, that can take her mind off the sensation of the strange woman's fingers. She imagines herself as a fish Miss Ruby rubs down with salt and vinegar before frying. Her eyes find the ceiling. Had she been able to lift her arm, she would trace the things she sees projected from her mind. Luckily, you have good hair already, Miss Ruby says. Good coolie hair. Your daddy's an Indian? I don't know, Tandy says, still staring up at the planks in the ceiling. Never met him. Well, God played a cruel trick on you, because, child, if your skin was as pretty as your hair, you'd be one gorgeous woman. Miss Ruby isn't saying anything Tandy hasn't heard before. Her mother says the same thing, often shaking her head the way she does over burned food that has to go to waste. It's a pity you never have skin like your daddy. Tandy's needed the nutmeg brown that makes her sister Margot an honorable mistress, a rung lower than a bright-skinned wife. Nor is she black like her mother Dolores, whose skin makes people sympathetic when they see her. Who want to be black like that in this place? Miss Ruby once said to Tandy about her mother. Miss Ruby gives Tandy the homemade mixture in the jar for her to apply as needed. Only as needed, she stresses. These are very strong chemicals that could kill you. She then reaches for the saran wrap and begins to wrap Tandy's arms and torso.
So Tandy walks around for quite a long time in discomfort with this chemical concoction on her skin and with the saran wrap.
Exactly. And then the sweatshirt over that
to hide
as well.
It,
exactly.
To hide what she's doing. Colorism isn't unique to Jamaica, of course, but it seems that in our country, the concept of beauty is shifting. Oscar winner, for instance, Lupita Nyong'o is getting a lot of coverage on TV and in fashion magazines. Do you see colorism beginning to fade in Jamaica?
Yes. No, it has been in the sense of, well, let me explain why I say that. Because right now, the girls who are coming here, the high fashion models in Jamaica, now they're actually, you know, dark skin, right? And, you know, on the darkest side. And But before that, a lot of our Miss Jamaica Universe and Miss World currently are actually white Jamaicans, or the mixture that's mostly lighter skin. And so it's really, no, little girls are looking to those girls, Miss Universe, Miss World, as the epitome of beauty. And to me, that's problematic because, you know, their pictures are on the calendar. They're everywhere. So these little girls are looking at this saying, oh, my gosh, I'm not beautiful because I don't look like them. I don't have hair like that.
Sure.
And so that's
good
still
hair,
good hair. Yeah. Exactly. And yeah, that's still rampant. That's still something that's prevalent on the island right now as well.
Just in listening to you read your passage from your book, Here Comes the Sun, it just seems such a cruel narrative to teach a young girl coming up, and something hard to carry for the rest of your life. You feel less than.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I personally have, you know, growing up, you know, I was one of those black girls, those dark skinned black girls who felt like, wow, I'm not seeing myself on screen. I'm not seeing myself represented as Miss Jamaica Universe, Miss Jamaica World. So what is that saying to me?
And what
to
did
my
it
friends,
say to you?
It actually
up.
Said
did...
that we weren't attractive enough. We weren't. I mean, yes, we were educated, we were intelligent. Because one thing, I listened to a lot of conversations about why girls like us don't get chosen to represent the country. And one of the biggest things that you'll hear is that, oh, because we weren't educated in the schools that those girls were educated in. That means we're not articulate enough. And I am saying to myself, but wait, I went to St. Andrew High School for Girls. There are so many girls on the islands who had gone to these great schools. And, you know, still the same results. Not they're not regarded as the Miss Jamaica Worlds or Miss Jamaica Universe. And I mean, the only truth in that statement, though, is that a lot of darker skinned Jamaicans, you know, the working class impoverished Jamaicans, they're disenfranchised. You know, they don't have the education. So true. Yes, our education is not for free like it is here in this country. We have to pay the school fee and the school uniforms and the books. So, yeah, a lot of kids actually get left behind as well. And just to speak to on what Tandy's doing with the bleaching, that's very prevalent in Jamaica as well.
To this day.
To this day, yes. And now it has even gotten more because now the creams are imported from various places, like Europe, for example, or even the U.S. It's not tested. And these girls and boys would rub their skin thinking that they can actually have the access that the upper class have by having that lighter skin. So it's really the desperation. And another thing too, a lot of Jamaicans look at these kids and say, oh my gosh, you know, they criticize them, they make fun of them, but really what they are showing us is that this is a product of the country not validating these individuals. You know, we have a very, very famous dancehall artist, Vybz Kartel. He actually sang about this. You know, he bleaches his skin as well. And when he started doing it, he faced a lot of criticism. But one thing that I think Vybz Kartel was actually showing Jamaica, because, you know, a lot of people would call Vybz Kartel the voice of Jamaica. He's showing the working class and impoverished what they perceive access to look like.
Sure.
And that's what he's wearing on his skin as well.
Were you ever tempted to do that?
I was. Sure. I was. You know, there was this skin cream called Naniola back in the day. I'm not sure it still exists on the market. Mm-hmm. But that was a cream. People used to use it on their elbows, you know, because, you know, if they're very concerned about their elbows or knees getting darker than their skin. But a lot of girls, you know, of my hue, you know, they would rub it on. And so back in high school, I went to the high school where, you know, a lot of us, we were looking at girls who were, you know, lighter skin with the quote unquote long hair.
Sure.
And saying to ourselves, oh, how is that possible? How can you achieve that? Not realizing that it's all genetics. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this now wearing my dreadlocks and loving my beautiful dark complexion.
So you're happy in
right.
your skin.
Yes, yes. But back then, it was a terrible message that was being sent to darker-skinned working-class girls
and boys. So you are
and a
darker-skinned woman, and you are married to a woman. And
yes.
Do these factors contribute to your leaving Jamaica?
No, multiple factors. Well, you did mention, yes. So class-wise, yes. I felt if I had stayed in Jamaica, I would not have had the prospects I have right now. You know, yes, I could have ended up at the University of West Indies for sure, but I would have probably graduated and still not be able to rise up, to leave my working class status at all. I have friends there who have graduated from the university they're working as security guards, or they're working in jobs that they don't want to work because there's no, they don't have the family name or the connections to, let's say, do something that they really want to do. And to me, that's something that's, you know, it's really saddening as well.
All right, let's get to the telephones. Sean in Germantown is standing by. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how you doing, Marty? Hi, Nicole.
Hi, how are you?
It's Mary, but doing well. Thanks, Sean. Marty's got a day off.
Yes, and gladly so. This program resonates so much emotion within me. I can attest to a lot of the stuff that Nicole is saying. Classism, colorism, and homosexuality.
All right.
Hello?
So you can relate in which way, Sean?
Well,
which ways?
I grew up in a family where my mom, I'm light skinned, blue eyes, Jamaican, and my brother is dark skinned. And so there was a clear divide between how we were treated. I wasn't allowed to be outside playing in the sun when my brother had his fetch the wood, even though I wanted to fetch wood and do all the menial work around the yard, and I was allowed to stay inside and watch TV and not deal with any of those, you know, social economic standards that people have to deal with when you're dark and poor.
And just curious, Sean, how did that affect the relationships in your family?
That drove a wedge between my brother and I. And I think I didn't know my brother had such hatred for me until I migrated to the States. Mm-hmm. And just when the story changed, I decided to come out to him as my brother to, like, tell him about my secret life, because, as Nicole said, this is the thing that you don't let anyone know about because you could be killed. And so I confided in him on one visit when he came to visit me, and on my next visit back to Jamaica, everyone ostracized me, and I didn't know why. No one said hi to me. It was like walking into a dead zone. And then another relative of mine told me, look, you might want to leave because people have been saying some things about you that's not good, so don't come around. And that broke my heart, and I just felt like my brother betrayed me in that way.
Oh, that's a... You're nodding your head, Nicole. You probably heard this sort of story before.
Definitely.
And Sean, thanks so much for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely understand his story. You know, you definitely can be ostracized for coming out as gay by your own family. Nobody talks to you, especially if you're from a very religious family as well there. And, you know, I feel for Sean in that, you know, as a male, for them, it's such brutality that's associated with that, for sure. And then I also wanted to comment on his brother and his relationship in that, yes, it's so interesting that he's acknowledging the privilege that he had growing up, and that this divide between family members that could definitely happen. It has happened so many times. I've seen cousins and even siblings not speak because of the complexion divide there. Because when you're lighter skin complexion, even if you're a working class, you can be accepted into the upper class realm because you look like one of them, you know. So that it's such a complex reality to navigate as well.
I'd like to get to just some quick comments. A tweet from Marcia who says, I just heard the phrase post-colonialism on Radio Times. Love it. Thank you. I will definitely read, says Marcia. She's going to read your book. And a tweet from a young poet. I love the description of Dolores. She sounds like a human forced into situations who has to make decisions we all hope to never face. Do the characters, do Tandy, do Margot, do they ever come close to feeling some sort of reconciliation with Dolores? Even if it's not spoken in the book, do you think that there's an acknowledgement of what Dolores had to go through in order to keep the family going?
Not by Tandy, definitely not. She definitely doesn't. I mean, she's a teenager, 15 years old. Margot, on the other hand, I could see Margot somewhat, you know, there was an initial scene, I think on page 20 or so, where Margot is still waiting for an apology. And somehow Margot still struggles because Margot very much wants Dolores' attention. And somehow there must be something inside Margot that's still gravitating towards her mother. But I mean, that's her mother. But I'm guessing that could also extend to understanding as well. You know, but for Margot's character, that what Dolores did to her was very unforgivable.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting in terms of her character, wanting, still very much wanting Dolores' love. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so that to me makes Margaret even a much more complex character as well.
And Dolores doesn't think she owes anybody an apology.
No.
No. So what happened with the character of Margot, it set her on this path of, I guess you could call it promiscuity, but she was prostituting herself again to bring money into the family and to try to prevent Tandy from going
right.
down to live a better life.
Yes.
What is Dolores's backstory?
Yeah, so Dolores, and you know, I wanted to make a point just now about Dolores. You know, you asked if she owes it, if she feels she owes anyone an apology. You know, she to Dolores, for Dolores, she'd rather not feel at all. You know, she'd rather not feel that because for her, it's still hurtful. Like, you know, that scene where she feels that Tandy's drawing reveals so much backstory, so much of what she did to Margot. And it actually brings her to this vulnerable state as a mother. And so, you know, for her not to feel that, to sit in that, she becomes callous. You know, that's her only way to actually get over this, right, to reconcile. And then in terms of Margot, how Margot continues this prostitution, you know, that's all she knows. I mean, she was 14 years old. So that's the only way she knows how to make money.
She comes to accept it.
Right.
And becomes calloused herself.
Exactly. Right. So for mm-hmm. her body is a commodity. And, you know, and so that's why, you know, her love for Verdi, there's no love for Margot. In Margot's eyes, everything has a price. Right. And it's just unfortunate how she learned that. And that's what she uses.
All right, we're talking about the novel Here Comes the Sun, written by Nicole Dennis-Benn, and she's here for the full hour of Radio Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And our guest this hour is Nicole Dennis-Benn, talking about her new novel, Here Comes the Sun. And again, if you've got questions or any observations, the number to call is 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let's get to some of those telephone calls. Sherry Ann at Temple is here with us now on Radio Times. Hello, Sherry Ann.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Hello, Nicole.
Hi, Sherry Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So I must put a disclosure. Nicole and I have been friends for quite a long time. We're both from Jamaica.
I was wondering.
There's no way I could not have called in while she was on.
So, well, thank you for calling and joining
yes.
the conversation and catching up with Nicole. So what's on your mind? What are you thinking, Sherry-Ann?
I'm thinking more about the process of the publishing, especially around getting patois in a book. And wondering how it's similar to kind of what we've been talking about, commodity and the price we pay in terms of how things have to be presented, whether you have to be a certain complexion. So, Nicole, the question I have is, as you were doing this book and trying to get a place on the shelf for it, what was it like in terms of standard English versus patois? How do you negotiate that process for you as well as other upcoming writers and poets who want to use this rich language that we have in Jamaica, that it's often seen as second class. Hmm. What was that process like?
Thanks, yeah. Sherry-Ann.
Thank you for that question. For me, it was a challenge initially. You know, I always tell this story all the time. When I first started writing and going out on the market to get published, you know, the very, 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 very first time was in my MFA program. And, you know, there were questions of, oh my gosh, can you get this out? Like, can this be read in dialogue? And, you know, luckily I've met a wonderful, wonderful agent, Julie Barr. And, you know, when she read it, she heard the voices of the people. You know, in her eyes, this was authentic because, you know, how could two characters, especially of this class, be talking to each other unobserved in standard English, right? Mm. That would not make any sense for the book. And so, you know, in understanding that and knowing that, listen, this is authentic, two characters would be speaking patois, that to me was my first step in. And in terms of the rest of the publishing world, getting their hands on this and understanding, you know, I have a wonderful editor, Katie Anderson Adams, who also read and understood what I was trying to do with dialogue. And that to me is just golden, you know. And so I would definitely count my lucky blessings there, where in terms of, for me, you know, those things were aligned, and I was able to get my work out there and get my people out for other individuals to get to know who they are and how they sound.
Nicole Dennis-Benn, you also address the fact that during the development of resort areas like Montego Bay, the poor were pushed out.
Yes.
And in one passage, which I'd like you to read, the character Tandi is heading to the river to do some drawing. You'd mentioned she wanted to be an artist. And she passes a no trespassing sign on a beach where she used to play as a child because the hotels are being built along the coastline.
Yes. Slowly but surely, they're coming, like a dark sea. Little Bay, which used to be two towns over from Riverbank, was the first to go. Just 5 years ago, the people of Little Bay left in droves, forced out of their homes and into the streets. It was all over the news when it happened, since the people, out of anger, ended up blocking roads with planks and tires and burning them. In the past, developers would wait for landslides and other natural disasters to do their dirty work. But when tourism became the bread and butter for the island's economy, the developers and the government alike became ravenous, indifferent. In retaliation, people stole concrete blocks and cement and zinc from the new developments to rebuild homes in other places. But their pilfering brought soldiers with rifles and tear gas. The developers won the fight, and the people scattered like roaches. Some came to Riverbank begging to be taken in. Some fled to other parishes. Those who could not bear the stress of uprooting all their belongings to start a new life roamed the streets and mumbled to themselves. It was as though their own land had turned on them, swallowed up their homes and livestock and produce, and spat out the remains. By the time the workmen arrived in Riverbank, Little Bay had been long forgotten.
And the people of Little Bay had been forgotten. So they ended up on the street, and they ended up, many of them could not make a life for themselves after that.
Exactly.
And has that ended now, to the best of your knowledge?
To the best of my knowledge.
Of development and...
It's still going. It's still going. And the unfortunate thing is that you don't know what happens to these people who get displaced, right? You do see the beautiful palaces and castles in the form, well, their resorts, but you never know where those individuals go, right? I speculate that they probably might go to neighboring parishes or neighboring towns, perhaps coming to Kingston. Who knows where they are, but nobody talks about them. And like I said in this book, and even in other essays I've written, you know, they have no voice. The working class Jamaicans have no voice.
I was going to ask, because at least in this country, if there's an issue of eminent domain and land and being pushed out, you can at least have some recourse in the courts. There's nothing like that in Jamaica for the poor?
No, not at all. In fact, Anthony Bourdain, he's on CNN, of course, as you know. He did a great, great segment about Jamaica, and he talked about that. You know, he went to Portland, and he sat with some of these big hoteliers, and, you know, it's interesting how their conversations went, you know, in terms of they being so proud of developing Portland. And Portland is like the heart, like, to me, Portland is that gem of in the island where I hope no one discovers it, but it's inevitable that they will do. But it has the beaches, the caves, the forestry. Everything about Portland is just beautiful. And now the hoteliers are seeing that as money. And so, you know, you do have now the villas. Well, they've always been there, but now more coming. And, you know, they're charging prices like $600 a night for people, for tourists with money to stay there. And, you know, take advantage of Frenchman Cove and all those beautiful setting that Portland provides.
What does going back feel like for you?
I have a difficult time going back and seeing the changes that's happening, especially on the coast. Because for me, my family is from Kingston, but my grandparents are from the rural area in St. Mary. So, you know, our drives there, you know, was always scenic, a very scenic view. And every time I'm driving by, I always look out, you know, you could see the entire country on certain hills whenever you take a high altitude path. And there's always this great longing and regret and resentment, because it's like you yourself know that this is your country, or this, that's me speaking, this is my country, but I have no access to it. I have no access to the beauty, unless if I do have the money to access it. So, you know, you could
access it from a different angle now.
Right. Now, yeah. I'm accessing it from a different angle. Yeah. And I do feel like, yeah, my writing is taking me there for sure. You know, but prior to this, when I used to journey up into the hills and look over in the island, it wasn't mine. And I felt like there was a great loss there. And there's always a feeling of loss. Like, yes, I see my family, I see my friends, but there's still a loss, because I do feel like our culture is just being watered down, because now it's a prime tourist country, you know. And that's, you know, I mentioned earlier that some of the issues that we're touching on in this interview, they get covered up because people are afraid that individuals will hear about, oh, well, homophobia or classism, complexionism, all these things. This is like airing dirty laundry. And in my eyes, this book is a love letter to Jamaica. You know, I want individuals to read this book and come out thinking, wow, how can I change this to preserve the beauty, right? Because to me, the real beauty is in the people, it's in our culture, right? Not just in our land itself.
Do you bring your wife with you?
I do.
Is that, considering what we talked about earlier and the fact that you feel homophobia still exists, is that a comfortable experience
She surprised me because, I mean, she was born and raised here in America, right, from Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. And she loves Jamaica. And when we're there, we're not open in the streets. That would definitely, be like probably the suicide attempt. We go to the hotels and the villas. And because of the industry having to cater to tourists and anybody who has the ability to afford certain amenities, they would say, oh, a king size bed? Sure. You know, but, you know, it's not something like we don't go around flaunting that we're married and we're together as women. You know, they probably see us walking around and we're probably like two friends or two sisters. Right. But to announce out loud in certain circles, you know, wouldn't be recommended. But my friends there who I hang out with in Kingston, they've come to universities here. They're more exposed. And so we're insulated in that realm, which I'm happy about. But I'm still very saddened for those who don't have that ability.
So back to the fact that Jamaica is a paradise for the wealthy. Are the poor able to see the paradise for themselves at all? Or is there any sense of I'm here and it's, you know, the sky is blue and I can smell the sea? Or are they struggling too much to have a moment to do that?
Yeah, they're struggling too much to have a moment to look up and see the sky and see the beaches. And that's something that frustrates me too when I'm reading other Jamaican literature, especially by writers who are of the upper class, who don't see the struggle. So they write about the beach and not anything else having to do with people in that vicinity, for example. And, Alice Walker even said in The Color Purple, there was a scene where they were walking by the purple bushes, and, you know, the whole concept of, you know, God is angry when you don't take note of that beauty. Well, in Jamaica, for example, the working class or impoverished individuals are not going to, they have no time or even the luxury to pause and smell the sea breeze and feel it and see the sky. There's no, as I said before, the access and also even looking at the beauty is not on their mind. The first thing on their mind is money. How am I going to get from day to day? You know, how am I going to feed my children? How am I going to pay the school fee, which is not free? You know, all these other things that they think about.
All right. We've got a call from David in Flemington. Welcome to Radio Times, David.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. I'm enjoying your program.
Thanks.
Are there any estimates of the amount of tourist revenue flowing into Jamaica for legal versus illegal purposes, such as your guest has described involving the younger daughter?
The character in the book. Right. Yeah.
The character in the book.
I'm not sure that you would have that at hand.
No, I don't have that at hand. But I do know that, for example, a lot of, first of all, the industry itself, you know, they're looking to make money, right? So, you know, you'll have our artists, the art, like selling artwork. There are individuals who sell weed on the property, even though weed is not legal yet. And in terms of sex work, it's on the hush-hush. But I'm sure that, you know, it probably adds to the revenue, right? But I don't have any facts about that.
Yeah, I was wondering how much of the tourism industry money actually gets back to the impoverished, if there's any provision made by the government to build schools or help improve neighborhoods.
Do you right, know yeah, that? That's the thing. There are some hotels that are beginning to do that, actually. Rockhouse Hotel in Negril. They're actually helping to build schools. They're helping with scholarships. And that's why I really do commend them, because they're trying. And I think a lot of other hotels are following suit. And that's something that I really want to see more of, as opposed to them just keeping the money, you know. So I definitely would love that to happen more, you know, seeing like, oh, well, hotels in Kingston can fund a little secondary school or a basic school so that those kids don't have to pay money to go to get an education. So as far as I know, Rockhouse is the only one that I've known so far to have been doing that.
Okay. This question is going to kind of come out from left field. Were you raised in a faith tradition when you were grew up in Jamaica?
Yes, Christian.
Christian. Because, you know, throughout the novel, there's this, you know, tension, of course, between Margot and Verdine and the Christian population, which is seems to be a predominantly Catholic population. And,
yes.
You know, Pope Francis recently made some conciliatory overtures again to people who happen to be gay. I mean, do you have any thoughts about that? Does that move the conversation forward in your mind?
Or? In my mind, it does. However, but in terms of Jamaica, though, in the culture right now, I don't even think that's something they're willing to entertain. You know,
even though the Pope Catholic said, population
even among the Catholic population, you know, and one thing, though, this is also from observation growing up. A lot of the Catholics in Jamaica were also upper class as well. You know, they went to St. Peter and Paul, like churches like those. And so those are individuals who probably were more exposed, probably more educated. So, of course, they probably have embraced a lot of the LGBT populations there. If you know, they were people who came out in their church. I'm not sure. But for me, we grew up Pentecostal, you know, Church of God, which is even more strict in my eyes. You know, yeah. These are women who you have to wear your skirts to your ankles. You have to wear hats when you enter the church. And that's the tradition, you know, that I came from. And to this day, my own mother, for example, has converted, because she grew up Christian too, but now she's even stronger in her beliefs. And I was somewhere with her the other day, and she's like, I can't listen to that music because, you know, it's sinful. So I'm surprised that she's actually reading my book and enjoying it. And
so she is enjoying it.
She is enjoying it. And that took me by surprise as well, which I'm so happy about that.
So what's next for you? Do you have another novel in the works or writing?
I do,
yeah,
definitely.
And can you give us a little tease as to what it's about?
I would say it's set here in the United States. It's set in New York City and also in Jamaica. So this time I'm giving my readers both worlds.
Right, you live in New York City right
yes,
now.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I do. Yeah, so I mean, that's all I'm going to say for now.
Okay,
yes.
Fair enough. Well, Nicole Dennis Bennett, has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And Nicole's book, again, is Here Comes the Sun. Oh, and one quick question I did forget to ask. Where'd that name come from? Was it the Beatles tune? Did you know?
No, I did not even know about that before Here Comes the Sun. It was just me making that name up. You know, the irony of us hiding from the sun all our lives. And then here it is.
Got it. I'm glad I remembered that before we closed. Okay. And by the way, if our listeners, if you didn't get a chance to get in on the conversation and you want to add to it, just head to our Facebook page at whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find our podcasts there as well. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler, with help today from Nick Kowalski. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, sitting in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thank you.